Welcome to this special issue of Hematologic Oncology Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. In June, during the ASCO meeting in Chicago, we held a CME satellite symposium focused on a just-completed survey of U.S.-based oncologists in practice, in which we asked them to submit questions and cases for investigators to address, and we collected additional questions during the event with the promise that we would produce this audio program that carefully addressed many of these questions with our faculty in NHL, CLL, multiple myeloma, CML, and T-cell lymphomas. To begin, I met with myeloma investigator Dr. Antonio Palumbo, and to begin, I started rattling off my list of questions from oncologists. What's the best dose of maintenance lenalidomide? 10 milligrams every day, 15 every day, 25 for 3 out of 4 weeks?
That's a very good question. The best dose is 10 milligrams a day, 121 every 28 days. And on top of that, I would also add to actually check the neutrophil every 1 or 2 months and restart treatment if your neutrophil count is over at least 1,000 per cubic millimeter. If it's not, please wait a couple of weeks, even more, but restart treatment with at least 1,000 neutrophils.
And I'll put in a sub-question in that, would you do an arbitrary preemptive dose reduction in an older patient?
No, 10 milligrams, 3 weeks on, 1 week off is, I would say, even pretty safe in elderly patient. I'm not suggesting 10 milligrams every single day. I'm not definitely suggesting 15 milligrams. 10 milligrams 3 week on, 1 week off is already safe, and I would just check every 1 or 2 months if it's tolerated from a neutrophil point of view.
Okay, sort of a related question. Are you concerned about peripheral blood stem cell yield in patients receiving lenalidomide as part of induction regimen?
Yes and no. No, if you only use 4 courses of Lendex, then you mobilize, preferably with cyclophosphamide followed by G-CSF instead of G-CSF alone. Has been clearly shown that after 4 courses of Lendex and mobilization with cyclophosphamide and G-CSF, the ability to collect the right number of stem cells is possible in more than 96% of patients. If you give more than 4 cycles, then you start to run in troubles. If you give 6, 12, 18 courses, then you will see a reasonable reduction in terms of stem cell yield.
So again, I'll throw in my sub-question and ask you, do we know anything biologically about exactly how lenalidomide affects the marrow?
Yeah, probably is everything going together. You have myelotoxicity. Myelotoxicity is probably affecting the myeloid lineage. The myeloid lineage is probably reducing a little bit the number of stem cells. And the other issue is totally unknown, but is a theoretical issue. Lenalidomide, to some extent, hit higher in the maturation process. So I'm not saying it's hitting the stem cell, but certainly is maybe hitting early on in the maturation of the hematopoietic lineages. And from this point of view, this could be even a plus in terms of efficacy as myeloma treatment is concerned.
One more sub-question, as long as we're in this area, which of course is what everybody wants to know about, and that is second cancers and lenalidomide. Can you talk about what was presented at ASCO in that regard, including your presentation?
Well, generally speaking, the comment on second malignancy is the following. The risk of second malignancy is at present not higher of what you can see in the normal population of the same age. Consider that in normal subjects, the risk of secondary malignancy is around 2% for every single year of life. And at present, in all trials, the risk is below 2% per year of life or year of follow-up. Having said that, there is a difference between the control arm where the risk is lower and the lenalidomide arm where the risk is higher. So the risk is low but higher in comparison to the control arm of those phase 3 randomized studies.
Is it your belief that there's an increase in solid tumors?
Generally speaking, my belief is that there is no increase in solid tumors. The risk is an increase in acute myelogenous leukemia and myelodysplastic syndrome. And this is consistent with the idea of the drug hitting the stem cell and affecting, from this point of view, the myeloid lineage. And this is also explaining why the general risk is not so increased. But if you consider the risk of AML and myelodysplastic syndrome, that is a very rare tumor, this is 5 times higher in comparison to the control arm.
Do we know whether it's increased further or in particular in patients who've gotten alkylating agents?
The risk of secondary malignancy is only present when you give lenalidomide in combination with alkylating agent or after high-dose melphalan, including in the transplant setting. There is no risk whatsoever of second malignancy if your treatment is lenalidomide plus corticosteroid. So the risk of secondary malignancy, and at this point basically the risk of AML and myelodysplastic syndrome, is only related to combination including lenalidomide and alkylating agent. I would say even probably only melphalan.
So here's another question that's related to your many interests. Weekly bortezomib was shown to be equivalent to biweekly in the setting of triple or quadruple therapy, and you can tell me if that's true. Can you make the same assumption if you use bortezomib plus dex?
I actually don't know. Let's put it this way. In a 3-drug combo or in a 4-drug combo has been clearly shown that weekly is equally or even more effective than twice weekly. Why? Because in the 3- and 4-drug combo, the twice weekly is becoming too toxic, the rate of discontinuation is increasing, so the cumulative dose is at the end of the day less than what you want to give at the beginning of the treatment. So in the 3- and in the 2-drug combination, you are giving less of what you think to give, and that's the reason why weekly is equally or more effective in combination to twice. When you use bortezomib with dexamethasone only, I would make this statement, although I do not have any evidence to say this, my impression would be I would certainly use weekly in subjects over the age of 65 because the risk of peripheral neuropathy is pretty high and you might end up with a reasonable incidence of early discontinuation. I would probably give twice weekly in patients younger than 65, but at the first sign of peripheral neuropathy, anything more than tingling, you immediately move from twice weekly to weekly.
I think there was a presentation by Nikhil Munshi at ASCO, but I don't think it was randomized, but it was looking at bortezomib weekly with dex. Are you familiar with that?
He didn't find any significant difference from the weekly to the twice weekly. But again, the data are not large enough to make a final conclusion. What I'm trying to give as a clinical judgment is that, of course, twice is better than once. But if you are giving twice and end up in discontinuation, at that point twice is less than once and you lose the efficacy. So my general statement is give twice to younger patients to not run risk of serious peripheral neuropathy.
So kind of a related question. Difference in incidence of infection between biweekly and weekly bortezomib?
Not significant from this point of view. The twice weekly is not significant increase in the risk of infection. So from this point of view, I would say, generally speaking, novel agents are giving a risk of infection of around 10%. It is more or less similar, independently from the type of drug or the dosing you are using.
So again, sort of in the same vein, For patients who don't tolerate bortezomib IV because of neuropathy, any role for trying it again subcutaneous?
Absolutely, yes. I think subcutaneously will certainly substitute the IV injection. Subcutaneously is reducing, as a general idea, the risk of peripheral neuropathy of 20%. So from this point of view, whenever is possible, whenever you have the availability of the sub-Q formulation, immediately move from intravenous to sub-Q.
Last time I talked to you about this was a couple months ago. What's going on right now in Italy in terms of access to subcutaneous bortezomib?
Well, for us, it will take probably a little bit longer. We are probably waiting another 3 to 6 months to have the availability, because here you are much more strict in terms of drug availability also, because generally speaking, the reimbursement here is a public insured reimbursement, and so the availability is strictly bound to the public reimbursement.
And in terms of sub-Q, what about the schedule? Twice weekly, is that sort of mandatory?
No, I would take the advantage of a further decrease in terms of side effects of the sub-Q, but I would not combine sub-Q with twice weekly. The rules we have established for the IV infusion should be equally maintained for the sub-Q in order to further improve the reduced risk of peripheral neuropathy. Do not change what we have established until now with the intravenous injection. Just move from intravenous to sub-Q.
Okay, so again, sort of in the same vein, here's a question. Explain your thought process when evaluating a patient with incompletely controlled diabetes and some mild neuropathy who's being evaluated for myeloma treatment, both in terms of dex and bortezomib.
Well, the peripheral neuropathy to some extent should be considered an independent factor. So sometimes it's difficult to predict, of course, but sometimes the peripheral neuropathy coming from diabetes doesn't mean you immediately will have an increase in risk of peripheral neuropathy due by bortezomib. So generally speaking, I would use certainly the weekly dose. I would use immediately stop and reduce if I have an increase in peripheral neuropathy, but I wouldn't take a particular attention to the diabetes issue unless you have a significant grade 2 or more peripheral neuropathy. And at that point, if you have more than grade 1, you immediately go to another drug such as lenalidomide. In terms of dexamethasone, I would probably reduce. The first issue is, can you control the diabetes with insulin or oral antidiabetics? Yes or no? If you can, I would use this as a first choice. If you cannot, I would certainly reduce the dose to dexamethasone to 20 milligram without pushing too much the insulin adjustment or therapy, while I would try to keep the patient between 10 and 20 milligrams of dexamethasone.
You know, it's interesting, this question of diabetes, you would think this would be more anecdotal, but do we actually have data on this issue of what you were saying, that it's sort of independent? I sort of assumed, okay, you start out with, you know, X neuropathy, and you sort of add on to that, but is that not the way to look at it?
Well, actually, you know, I do not have an extensive study to make this statement and be sure what I'm saying is right. Generally speaking, what I see in my practice is that the development of peripheral neuropathy from bortezomib is highly subjective for reason not clear to us and certainly not related to diabetes. I saw patients with diabetes without any problem, patients without diabetes with major problems, so I do not see a strict relation between diabetes and peripheral neuropathy. Of course, I do not have 500 patient series to make a final assessment.
So this was a much debated topic when we had our big working group meeting in Miami that you were nice enough to come over for. Do you differentiate prognosis of conventional cytogenetics in fish? Is 13q equally important if found only by fish?
That's a great debate basically between Europe and US. Let's make these two statements. Deletion 13 alone is not a bad prognostic factor, so do not consider any longer. Actually, now the best panel in terms of definition of bad prognosis should be considered translocation 414, deletion 17, and amplification 1Q. These are the three major parameters to determine bad prognosis. Having said that, in Europe, the 95% of physicians are giving the same treatment to all patients. The rationale is that since we are not curing anyone, there is no reason to give a less effective treatment to good prognosis and what we consider a more active treatment to a bad prognosis patient. We should deliver what we consider the best possible option to all patients. Why this? Because bad prognosis means resistant disease, good prognosis means sensitive disease. So it doesn't make any sense to give less treatment to sensitive disease and more treatment to resistant disease, because you are losing the opportunity to have a very long remission duration in sensitive disease. So since we are not curing anyone, our judgment is what we consider the best treatment option should be given to all patients. What is making the difference today in terms of treatment is actually age, but this is basically all about differentiation of treatment for myeloma patient.
I'm going to skip down to another question that I think might be related to what you just said. Question mark, bortezomib maintenance. So is that an example of something that maybe would change in terms of your treatment algorithm based on risk?
No, in my opinion, we have been seeing both bortezomib and lenalidomide effective in terms of maintenance. Generally speaking, to give you an idea, if treatment for elderly patient for a fixed period of time are giving 24, 25, 27 months of median progression-free survival, when you add the maintenance, you always are over 30 months, 31, 34, 37 months of median progression-free survival. So generally speaking, continuous treatment is approximately increasing the median progression-free survival of around 10 months over combination, including novel agent, for a fixed period of time. We do not know, of course, if LEN is better than BORT. We do know that LEN or BORT are better than thalidomide, mainly because thalidomide, you cannot give it as a maintenance approach because usually the median duration of treatment with thalidomide is less than 1 year. So this is just basically a consolidation, not a maintenance. So we know that LEN and BORT are superior. We do not know if LEN is better than BORT or vice versa. Of course, LEN has a major advantage due by the oral administration. And if you want a lower risk of peripheral neuropathy, that even with a twice monthly infusion of bortezomib is still around 6-8%.
So you're not necessarily more likely to use bortezomib as maintenance in a patient who has a higher risk myeloma?
Actually, no, because again, the concept is the same. The moment we are not using bortezomib for high-risk myeloma, we are not using bortezomib for high-risk maintenance.
Okay, what is the role of PET scan in multiple myeloma?
That's another very important and interesting question with at present some gray zone. Generally speaking, I would like to make this comment. More sophisticated imaging techniques are certainly useful in myeloma. Use those techniques when you want to start treatment if you have an absolutely clear evidence of organ damage. The risk with those sophisticated imaging techniques is that you might start collecting very small lesions. And from this point of view, you might also have some risk in clear assessment of positivity or negativity. Both the sensitivity and the specificity is not very high with those techniques. So use it, but don't pay too much attention to very small lesion. This might be false negative. This might give you misleading information. So they have a great role, provided they are really giving evidence of a major osteolytic lesion and therefore evidence of organ damage. This is to define when you start treatment. CT PET scan may have also a role in defining CR, because we know that immunofixation negative CR may still have some positive PET scan. So generally speaking, we know that immunofixation negative CR doesn't mean we are free of disease. Disease is still there, and you can detect it with dose imaging. The issue in this perspective is more or less the same of high risk of low risk. Again, since we should give our best treatment to our patient and to some extent to keep treating patient because you still have a positive CT PET scan is something we honestly don't do.
I like the way some of these questions are worded. I threw this one out at Sergio Giralt just to get his blood pressure up a little bit. Is it the time to read the obituary of transplant and multiple myeloma? In the era of novel therapies, would you agree that transplant would not be required except for a very small group of very high-risk patients?
Well, this might lower very much the blood pressure of Sergio Giralt because actually we perform a study in patient younger than 65. This is a large randomized study, more than 500 patients randomized to conventional treatment, including novel agents such as lenalidomide, versus induction with novel agent followed by autologous transplant. The answer is clear. Autologous transplant is significantly prolonging progression-free survival in comparison to conventional treatment, including novel agent. So at present, the standard of care should remain autologous transplant for patients younger than 65. And again, no reason to make this assessment only on high-risk patients. This was a study performed on all patients younger than 65, both good and high-risk patients.
Of course, you just presented that data, but if I remember correctly, you showed a progression-free survival advantage, but not an overall survival advantage. Is that because it's not mature enough, there are not enough events, or because it doesn't affect survival?
My expectation is that might affect survival too. It's just an expectation. I think the follow-up is, of course, right now, absolutely too short to make any assessment on overall survival. The expectation is that might affect overall survival as well. But again, the improvement in progression-free survival is, in my opinion, already enough to show that one treatment may be better than another one.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Has there been another randomized study looking at transplant in the era of novel agents? I mean, when novel agents were involved.
This is the first one. We will see other major free trials. There is another trial, again, comparing with lenalidomide, cyclophosphamide versus lenalidomide followed by autologous transplant. And there are other two trials. One, again, in Europe is bortezomib melphalan versus bortezomib followed by autologous transplant. And then there is another trial, the French and the FCI trial, comparing bortezomib lenalidomide versus autologous transplant. So we will have probably in 2 to 3 years, basically 4 trials addressing the same question. 2 trials on the lenalidomide setting, the other trials on the bortezomib even bortezomib lenalidomide setting.
So does this mean that in general, outside of a protocol setting, you're encouraging patients to go ahead with an immediate transplant instead of just harvesting cells?
Absolutely, yes. I think the evidence today is in favor of autologous transplant immediately after diagnosis, after 4 courses of induction. If I can, my best choice for a younger patient should be 4 cycles of induction, probably including bortezomib and a third agent such as lenalidomide, followed by autologous transplant, followed again by consolidation with bortezomib and a third agent plus dexamethasone, followed by lenalidomide maintenance. This today, in my opinion, could be considered the best possible care for a younger patient.
Okay, a couple of cases were submitted. 58-year-old man, he says the patient actually is a physician, diagnosed with IgG, kappa myeloma, 80% bone marrow involvement, M spike 10 grams, induction RVD with a VGPR, goes on to auto transplant with very minimal change in the M spike. Two cycles of consolidation lenalidomide with some improvement. Now on maintenance lenalidomide with slow increase in M spike. Any role for further consolidation regimens? Patient has neuropathy from prior bortezomib.
This is a very important question, is how to handle it, if I understood correctly, a maintenance who is showing what we call a biochemical relapse, a small increase in the M component without symptomatic disease. From this point of view, our suggestion is first certainly move from LEN 10 milligrams to LEN 25 milligrams, so the full dose of lenalidomide. Second, immediately had low-dose dexamethasone, 40 milligrams per week, eventually even a higher dose of dexamethasone, such as 40 milligrams four times twice a month. So you double the dose of the low-dose dex administration. Third, eventually, even if these measures are not effective, a third agent, such as in this case cyclophosphamide, in order to re-maintain the remission.
Here's another case. I have a 60-year-old patient with non-secretory myeloma who presented with severe pancytopenia, platelets less than 20,000, ANC less than 500, hemoglobin 7, bone marrow biopsy showed 80% plasma cells, kappa restricted, no M spike, no lytic lesions, no renal insufficiency. What's the best treatment? Of note, he has good performance status and no significant comorbidities.
Just one issue. This is an untreated patient before, or he has been already exposed to many other agents.
He doesn't say anything about treatment, so I assume not.
So my issue would be, since there is a 80% plasma cell infiltration, if this is an untreated patient, there is more than 90% chance that this is a sensitive disease, and from this point of view, I would certainly use a combination including bortezomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone to maximize the possibility to reduce the tumor mass, and from this point of view, probably even at that point increase both a neutrophil and the platelet. If, on the other hand, that this is a patient already exposed to both bortezomib or lenalidomide, and we have a pancytopenia that is probably due not only by the bone marrow infiltration, but also by an extensive exposure to chemotherapy agent, at that point, we should look at the novel agents such as pomalidomide or carfilzomib, even better carfilzomib because it has a very little hematologic toxicity. And certainly what we do, we reintroduce thalidomide because have a very low myelotoxicity. So when we have a patient that has been extensively treated and therefore might have a very low marrow reserve, we try to move to agents such as thalidomide or carfilzomib with very limited myelotoxicity.
You know, speaking of carfilzomib, my understanding of the mechanism of action of proteasome inhibitors is still at the trash can type stage, if you know what I mean. And when I heard Ken Anderson give the Karnofsky lecture, he went into some things about proteasome inhibitors I'd never heard before. He talked about something called, I think, chymotrypsin or something, and there were these different components of the proteasome. Any comment on that and the biology and what we know about sort of how carfilzomib works compared to bortezomib at a biologic level?
At the biological level, basically, these proteasome inhibitors may have a different bind to the proteasome. So one major biological issue is they can bind to the protein at different levels. So this is action number one. Action number two is how much the bind is stable and irreversible. And from this point of view, carfilzomib is a little bit different from bortezomib. So from a mechanism point of view, there are two major actions. One is which is the binding site. Two, how is irreversible the binding of them.
Is it correct to say that carfilzomib is irreversible
Yes.
and bortezomib is reversible?
Carfilzomib is irreversible in comparison to bortezomib, that is more reversible from this point of view.
More reversible, okay. Anything else you want to say about this patient?
No, you know, my point was to make a distinction between a newly diagnosed person where I would certainly try an intensive, although even myelotoxic approach in order to reduce the disease, or an advanced stage of diseases with probably a resistant myeloma, where I would try to use drugs that are minimizing the risk of myelotoxicity.
Just to finish up, though, on carfilzomib, what's your understanding, again, at a biologic level for why it seems to have much less or no neuropathy compared to bortezomib?
That's a $1 million question we cannot answer. It's funny, you see, to some level, all those drugs, even IMID, may have some sort of peripheral neuropathy. We do not have any evidence that the drug might attach some axons or neurological structure, but it's certainly interesting that all those drugs to some level may have a yes or not peripheral neuropathy. Thalidomide has it, lenalidomide doesn't have it, pomalidomide start to have again a little bit. It's the same story for those second or third generation proteasome inhibitors. For some reason, probably the binding site is changing, as we were saying before, and therefore this different binding site might less interact with neurological structure in comparison to the cousin drug. Let's put it this way. This is my best possible explanation, although everything is totally theoretical.
Speaking of pomalidomide, at our working group, Maury Gertz was verbalizing his feeling that there was less toxicity, less dermatologic toxicity, less thrombogenesis. Do you agree with that, with pomalidomide as opposed to the other IMIDs?
Generally speaking, I would say that pomalidomide has a myelotoxicity that is increased over thalidomide, has less skin rash. I do agree about that. And I do also agree that has a less risk of thromboembolic event, although, generally speaking, today, the risk of DVT with IMIDs and the use of aspirin prophylaxis or heparin if you have a patient with high risk of thrombosis is really below 3-4%. So it's, at this point, difficult to say that, you know, 1-2% versus 4-5%. But certainly seems to be lower than other agents.
Okay, here's another one. What is the data for lenalidomide maintenance in the non-transplant setting?
Even more important than in transplant setting, in my opinion, because in the non-transplant setting, continuous treatment is even more important than with transplant. With transplant, you have a major cytoreduction. You probably have, with high-dose melphalan, a sort of damaging of the myeloma stem cells that, from this point of view by itself at this point, seems to prolong the remission duration. So with transplant, a high response rate and less, if you want, need of maintenance. Without transplant, less response rate, less CR rate, more disease in the patient, and therefore even more need of continuous treatment to prolong the remission as much as possible.
So a couple bone questions. Even though the denosumab trial was negative, would you consider this in a patient with renal failure?
Yes, we can certainly consider if we have some major contraindication with bisphosphonate. the study for denosumab in myeloma was in a subgroup of patients. Certainly, the evidence today is not for yes or no, because generally speaking, they didn't have the numbers to make this sort of assessment. So yes, I would.
On a related level, I think, well, at least in terms of being a bone question, do you continue bisphosphonates until progression? And I guess the flip side of that would be, for how long do you continue it?
Another 1 million question. If I can go to the previous one, looking at the evidence we have, denosumab, yes, if we have contraindication for bisphosphonate. Otherwise, I would probably wait to more evidence to use denosumab if we do not have any major contraindication for regular bisphosphonate. Coming back to the other question, this is a very important question, because the ASCO guidelines are suggesting to use bisphosphonate for no more than 2 years due to the risk of ONJ. The recent study presented by Morgan by the MRC UK cooperative group is, on the other hand, showing that the advantage of bisphosphonate treatment is related to the time of exposure. So looking at this huge study that show not only reduced risk of skeletal event, but also an improved survival of around 6 months, this study is suggesting to use bisphosphonate until progression. On the other hand, we have to balance this evidence with a safety concern, because certainly the risk of ONJ is increasing when you prolong the treatment duration. And from this point of view, it's really a difficult issue, because evidence are that you should use it until progression, but be very, very concerned that the risk of ONJ might increase after 2 years of treatment.
Could you just clarify, we first started to see data from this MRC trial, I think it was a year ago, ASCO 2010, but they did a couple of sub-analyses at ASCO. Could you explain what they looked at and what it meant to you?
You're talking the sub-analysis. One of those subgroup analyses was looking at the different landmark analyses. They did landmark analyses at 6 and 12, 18, 24, and if I recall correctly, more than 24 months. And they were seeing that the advantage was consistent independently if you consider patients that have been treated for 6, 12, 18, 24 months. So even in patients with a longer exposure to bisphosphonate, the advantage was basically maintained and improved by the longer exposure.
And I guess the other thing was, they actually had patients in the study who did not have bone disease in the beginning.
And basically the advantage was more or less the same. So the studies are showing that also in patients without bone disease, there is an advantage in the use of bisphosphonate.
Although it seemed like it was more in bone events, the overall survival, I guess, was the whole population.
The overall survival was data coming from the whole population. The evaluation on patient without bone lesion had as an endpoint the risk of skeletal event. So it was mainly related to the risk of skeletal event.
Right, but that does bring up the question of bisphosphonates in patients without bone disease. What do you do?
I would certainly use it anyway, because it's also in patients without bone lesions. This is preventing the risk of new or developing new bone lesions.
So were you doing that before a year ago or because of this study?
No, I would have done also 1 year ago, yes.
Interesting. Okay, so we actually just got an email that I'm going to read to you. And it says, "Hi, I'm Dr. Chris Moffitt, a retired generalist in the UK. Developed myeloma in 2003, treated with VAD, then stem cell autograft 2004, recurrence, treated with thalidomide, looks like for a year, slow rise in paraproteins, January 2011, was treated with thalidomide 50 milligrams with a view to start bortezomib after a planned cruise. So he's out on the ocean, I guess, right now, trying to think about what he wants to do. I feel okay, some ankle swelling, peripheral neuropathy, both feet and ankles, but my hands are okay. Question, when to start bortezomib, now or later, sub-Q or IV? Appreciate your help.
Okay, generally speaking, I would start bortezomib when you have clear evidence of quoted symptomatic relapse. We make a distinction between biochemical relapse, that means an increasing M component of 25% without any symptoms, from a clinical relapse where, beside the increase in M component, we might have a lower in the hemoglobin, we might have evidence of a new bone lesion by X-ray, we might have an increase in creatinine level, or we might have a doubling of the N component in less of 2 months. If we are running one of those conditions, I would immediately start treatment. If, on the other hand, we have a slow increasing of the M component, without lowering of the hemoglobin, without increasing of the creatinine, without any evidence that some organ damage might occur, I would wait a little bit longer because you might be in a so-called smoldering situation where your disease is growing, but is growing slowly. From this point of view, I would prefer to cruise a little bit longer instead of starting bortezomib. Between bortezomib sub-Q and IV, if you have available sub-Q, I would certainly prefer sub-Q over IV. I would certainly use the weekly dose, and I would certainly use combination with dexamethasone.
I just realized that he didn't state his age, although he says he's retired. Would your approach to this vary dramatically if he were late 70s or 80s?
I would still use bortezomib. We can modulate the dose in those frail subjects, reducing from 1.3 to 1 on a weekly basis, reducing dexamethasone from 40 to 20 to even 10 on a weekly basis. And on the other hand, we sometimes even go to a twice monthly injection. It's very low, it's not as effective as the other, but may be an option in a very frail elderly subject.
I just realized too, I don't know if it's a man or woman because the name is Chris, but anyhow, I'm going to follow up with him, let him know what you said, and of course get his permission to use his name, and if we can always take it off after the fact. One other question. Could you delve into the details of adequacy of stem cell harvest after specific regimens and whether plexophore use may allow for greater collection?
That's a very good question. What we actually use is regular GCSF for the first mobilization with cyclophosphamide, but if we do not collect a good number of stem cells, we mobilize after 2 or 3 months with plerixafor. And this is certainly a good option in patients with a low harvest at the first mobilization, which is the minimum number of CD34 you want to have for an autologous transplant. 4 is certainly more than enough and is considered an excellent standard minimum number of stem cells to reinfuse for one autologous transplant. You can go down to 2 million of CD34 per kilograms to infuse after a single high-dose melphalan at 200 milligrams. So the minimum excellent standard is considered 4, but you can use down up to 2. Below 2 million, I would probably reduce the dose of melphalan from 200 to 140.
In follow-up to the discussion of the patient who was also a physician who asked for input on his own personal case of myeloma, we found out that Chris Moffitt is a 67-year-old man who is more than willing to have his email read and discussed on this program and is carefully considering Dr. Palumbo's input.